From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, government snooping goes public, a grilling for generals, Turkey in turmoil, the Supreme Court, and your DNA. One leak after another this week on vast telephone and internet surveillance by the U.S. government. Outrage at the leaks, outrage at the surveillance. Senator Dianne Feinstein tried to calm the waters.
And that's why this is carefully done. That's why it is a federal court of 11 judges who sit 24/7, who reviews these requests and then either approves them or denies them.
A phalanx of top Pentagon brass before an angry Senate committee this week on sexual assault. New York's Kirsten Gillibrand was blunt.
Not every single commander necessarily wants women in the force. Not every single commander can distinguish between a slap on the ass and a rape.
And big protests in Turkey. What started as a sit-in to protect a park from development has spread across the country. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with David Sanger of the New York Times, Nancy Cordes of CBS News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Is Big Brother watching you? Is that okay now? What are you thinking on Susan Rice, DNA, the chain of command? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us from Washington today, David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times, winner of two Pulitzer Prizes, author of last year's Confront and Conceal. David Sanger, welcome back to On Point.
Good to be with you.
And from Washington, Nancy Cordes is here, the great congressional correspondent at CBS News. Nancy, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be here.
And with me in the studio today, Jack Beatty. Jack, great to have you right here.
Hello, Tom, Nancy, and David.
David Sanger, jump right in. Can you summarize what the surveillance is that's been revealed this week, from phones to internet services to the NSA, right in the servers of Google and Facebook and right on down the line? What's going on, David?
Well, what we're learning is more details about programs that we've known in general existed, but I think whose scope was probably not clear to many of us, certainly to me, and whose specificity I think is probably a surprise to many Americans as it was to some members of Congress. Two different programs here. From the leak to Glenn Greenwald at The Guardian of a FISA court order, that's the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, a secret court that was established by Congress for times when the government needs to go get warrants that no one knows about against mostly foreign terrorists. We got the leak of an actual renewal of a sort of standing authority for the FBI and, by extension, the National Security Agency, which is the biggest of the intelligence agencies. This one was just to Verizon. And what it basically ordered Verizon to do was, on a pretty much a daily basis, dump all of its call logs, that is to say the telephone numbers that have been dialed and the duration of the calls, a few other pieces of what's called metadata around the call, but not the content, into a government database.
Can we likely assume, David, that if Verizon, this document came out with Verizon in it, but can we likely assume that all the other major telecom companies have gotten a similar document, a similar arrangement?
I think you have to assume it, because if what the government is trying to get, Tom, is a full understanding of how Person A in the United States, say the boss, one of the Boston bombing suspects, was talking to either Person B in the U.S. or Person C overseas, they would need all of them, because it's not clear that every terrorist has the same telephone
and
carrier.
And probably have them. So that's the phone side.
That's the phone side. And what was surprising there was that the government was taking and then retaining, and that's the key element, retaining this record. Now, the director of national intelligence in a statement last night said that without an additional court order, they can't go in and pull out one of those numbers and begin to examine who was talking to whom. But clearly, by having all the data, they can not only increase the speed at which they do it, but they can perform mathematical calculations and algorithms to see patterns of who's talking to whom.
So we've wondered about these huge data centers that have gone up around the country. We've reported them here at On Point. Here may be one big application for them. There's the phone side. And then the internet side, where they're, I mean, this leaked documents say that the NSA extracts what it wants, according to the document, collection directly from the servers of these U.S. service providers: Microsoft, Yahoo, Google, Facebook, Paltalk, AOL, Skype, YouTube, Apple, directly from the servers, David.
That's right. And that's what makes this one different. That in that case, if you believe this set of slides, mm-hmm. and we think there may be some imprecision of language, that the government then can go, has agreements. Again, the DNI insisted, the Director of National Intelligence, with court orders to be able to go into, say, a Facebook account or a Microsoft email or a Google search, again, of individuals. The question is what the mechanism is for how they actually get into that. It doesn't appear that those groups, at least as far as we know right now, dump all their data.
And foreign stuff only, they're saying, but it doesn't seem quite true necessarily when you read down into this, that it's only monitoring what goes on outside the U.S.
Well, it's very hard to if, let's say that you've got, you could imagine three different scenarios. One is a conversation that takes place entirely outside the U.S. but is routed through a U.S. server.
Mm-hmm.
And for that, previously, the government required getting a court order. Now, under a revision of the rules that happened last year, they do not. Then you could imagine a conversation between someone in the U.S. and outside the U.S. That's a typical case for the Foreign Intelligence Court.
Yep.
And then you could imagine a case completely within the U.S. And then the question is, if it's two people within the U.S. or two people who are American citizens, do they then have to go to a normal court and give you a chance to challenge that? Or does the FISA court apply? And that would depend on whether they were looking at a foreign plot.
Nancy Cordes, come in here. This whole PRISM, it's called, sounds very James Bondy, the name for all this PRISM. Washington Post and Guardian putting this out there, Post saying it was launched from the ashes of President George W. Bush's secret program of warrantless domestic surveillance in 07. And, of course, Congress came in here with the Protect America Act in 07, the FISA Amendments Act in 08, obliging to, I guess, make this possible. So how, what are you hearing from people in Congress? Are they defending, say, we did this, we needed to do it, it's the right thing, or we've got an offense against the American Constitution, Nancy?
Well, as far as PRISM is concerned, I think they're still sort of digesting it and trying to understand exactly what the scope is. When it comes to the phone records, initially after the Guardian report came out, there was sort of general alarm on Capitol Hill. What is this? What's happening? What does this mean? But very quickly, you had the leaders of the intelligence committees, both in the House and the Senate, Democrats and Republicans, come out and say, we have known about this for many years. We get briefed on a regular basis. We don't have any problems with this. In fact, this has stopped more than one terrorist attack here in the United States. And that was enough to sort of calm the concern among most members of Congress, but certainly not all, particularly the privacy advocates who have had big problems with the Patriot Act all along. Folks like Ron Wyden of Oregon, who's a Democrat, who said, look, I think when law-abiding Americans call their friends, then who they call and when they call and where they call should be private information. Collecting this data about every single phone call is just a massive invasion of Americans' privacy. And so there are there is a vocal minority out there like Wyden who think this is just too intrusive. But most members of Congress, once they heard from those intelligence chairs, seem to come to terms with what's going on, at least when it comes to the phone records.
I mean, between the Supreme Court's DNA ruling, you know, getting right into our very genetics, and this, at the very least, it feels like goalposts moving or boundaries moving here. But as you say, support coming from the Congress, from some parts. Here was Senate Majority Leader Democrat Harry Reid defending the government's action.
This is a program that's been in effect for 7 years, as I recall. It's a program that has worked to prevent not all terrorism, but certainly vast, vast majority of it. Now, is the program perfect? Of course not.
Not everybody was on board. Here's Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders on the Verizon phone records talking about them on CNN.
The bottom line is that the United States government now has phone records and other records of tens and tens and tens of millions of Americans who have nothing, absolutely nothing, to do with terrorism. I happen to believe terrorism is a serious issue. I want our law enforcement people to be vigorous and aggressive in going after terrorists, but we can do that without undermining the basic constitutional rights that have made this a great and free country.
Vermont's Bernie Sanders. Jack Beatty, what are you seeing as these leaks come out this week? Ironic, they come out in the same week that Bradley Manning's on trial for WikiLeaks leaking. But here, this is big. This is big, Jack.
It is big. And people say, well, it's different from the warrantless wiretapping under President Bush. For one thing, it's not wiretapping. As David said, it's metadata. They're not getting into the phone particular calls or the exchange. They can, but they need a warrant. And that there are checks. The Congress is checking. The judiciary is checking. That's exactly what I find disturbing, that all the branches of government are okay with what just a generation ago would have seemed an unwanted violation of privacy on the part of the Americans. And I think it's telling that Jim Sensenbrenner, the very conservative Republican from Wisconsin and the author of the Patriot Act, calls this un-American.
So everybody in cahoots in a way, or to look at it from the other side, as James Clapper would say, doing the necessary to keep the country safe, Jack.
To keep the country safe. Well, you know, what it reminds me of is Kafka's parable of the leopards in the temple. You know, leopards break into the temple and drink up the offering and the chalices. This happens again and again. Finally, you can predict their action in advance, and it becomes part of the ceremony. So the leopards are in the temple, and instead of being outraged at it, the government, all three branches say, well, it's become part of the ceremony now. This is how we do things in America.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, big surveillance, Susan Rice, Bradley Manning, the High Court and DNA, the military and sexual assault again. Nancy Cordes is with us, congressional correspondent for CBS News, joining us from Washington. David Sanger is here, chief Washington correspondent at the New York Times, and our own Jack Beatty. David Sanger, you've looked a lot at all kinds of digital shenanigans here and abroad. I mean, our listeners are coming in online. And, you know, a lot of them are sort of shrugging here. I mean, Dave says people are so outraged that Facebook gave up their private info, they voluntarily supply their private details all the time. I mean, maybe we're just in a different age, where it's all out there anyway, David.
Well, you know, I notice a generational difference here. Friends of mine who are a generation younger than me, who grew up in a Facebook and email and text messaging and instant messaging age, grow up recognizing that every hour of every day they are leaving a digital trail. And so I think their expectation of privacy is different from what we had as we were growing up, where you weren't leaving a digital trail, you weren't leaving necessarily any trail, and it was a whole lot easier to disappear. I find that younger people believe that if there's anything that's truly important, you would never commit it to, you know, your iPhone, your Facebook page, your Twitter account. Whereas I think many people who are, say, on the far side of 40 would have a different expectation. What we're discovering here is that the government's expectation is more like a 20-year-old's expectation at this point, that they have found this tool to be so useful to them that it was just too tempting to be able to have this huge library of data. And the only argument is, what kind of authorizations do they need to access it?
Our jejune government with the attitude of a 20-year-old, Nancy Cordes, I mean, Jack says, you know, a generation ago, people would have said, no way, no how. Have we shifted, evolved? We got tectonic plate movements here that just leave us in a different place. What about the old presumptions that seemed deeper, as David says, than what is now presumed?
Well, it's interesting. When you poll Americans and ask them about this, if you say, do you think it's okay for the government to get a hold of your phone records, for example, mm-hmm. then overwhelmingly people say no. If you ask the question, do you think it's okay for the government to get everyone's phone records in order to prevent a terrorist attack, a lot more people say yes. So, you know, on its face, people might be uncomfortable with the idea of anyone getting a hold of their private information. But if you ask them in terms of, you know, the greater good, this will protect you, but they're not actually getting any private information about what your conversation was, who you talked to, for how long, that kind of thing, then a lot more people say that they're okay with that trade-off.
New world, we're getting more naked here and trusting it not to be misused. Bonnie in Clive, Iowa is calling. Hi, Bonnie, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm 65, and I have no problem with what they're doing whatsoever. If you have nothing to worry about, if you're not doing anything illegal, if you're not doing a terrorist act, why do you care? I have no problem with it at all.
What about freedom, liberty, privacy, freedom from an overbearing, snooping government?
Nope. You know, the thing is, like I said, I'm on the Internet every day. I have a Facebook page. You know, if I put something on a Facebook, I'm expecting hate. The whole world can see that. You know, they can look at my phone records anytime. I don't think if you have nothing that you're doing illegal, if you're not a terrorist, I think now things have changed with 9/11 and with the world the way it is right now, and terrorists getting more and more smart and more technically savvy. I say, yay, government, protect me. Go ahead and look at my records. I got nothing to hide.
Bonnie, we've got it. I guess your windows are wide open, and we've got that perspective. Jeff in Nashville, you're on the air. Jeff, thanks for calling.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on, I'm 54 years old,
okay.
And I grew up in the late 60s, early 70s in my formative years, and I'm telling you, back then, people would have been in the streets if this kind of thing had happened, and I feel like it terrifies me that I have a son that's 24, that his generation is just handing over their privacy, you know.
Jeff, what are you scared of? Bonnie in Iowa says, look, if it's to get the bad guys, bring it on. I have nothing to hide. So what's the source? What's the root of your concern?
Our definition of who the bad guys are changes. And if you are a liberal and we have an ultra-conservative government, then you're the bad guy. And if you're ultra-conservative and we have an ultra-liberal government, then you're the bad guy. And I grew up in New England, where the Revolutionary War was fought. This is the kind of thing, it was just instilled in me, that we are to be a free people, and we're free from unlawful search and seizure, and people just invading our privacy for whatever reason they decide to. It's up to the government. It's no longer up to us.
Jeff, we've got it loud and clear, and I appreciate your call from Nashville. While we're on this subject, let's just pull it a little further over the Supreme Court decision that said when you're arrested, the police can take a swab that will put your genetic profile, your DNA, on file forever. That got a pretty tough response from conservative Antonin Scalia. Here's NBC's Pete Williams reporting on Scalia's dissent.
In a blistering dissent, conservative Antonin Scalia, joined by three of the court's liberals, said the Supreme Court is breaking new ground. Your DNA can be taken, Scalia said, if you are ever arrested, rightly or wrongly, for whatever reason. He said he doubted that the founding fathers, quote, would have been so eager to open their mouths for royal inspection.
Jack, there's the whole spectrum, you know, from our phone calls to our internet communications to our DNA. Now on file, if you're arrested, pulled over, you know, when you're young, the rest of your life, they've got it. I don't know what that means.
No, you know, for a long time, conservatives have said you just grow the government. The government gets big enough and technology changes and becomes big enough and more grasping. And you have the makings, the infrastructure of a kind of big brother state. And this week, you could see that between the technology and the science and the DNA and then the NSA hoovering up the location of every phone call in the country, it seems, that we have taken a vast step toward that. And it's as if, and the rationale, well, since we can do it, we will do it. I mean, Scalia's point is really well taken. Conservatives have been saying that about big government all my life.
But plenty of conservative justices were in favor of this decision.
They were. That's true.
And Jack, remember that the program that we're discussing here, both programs, both the telephone and the internet one, began in 2006 and 2007 in reaction to the Times' revelation of the warrantless wiretapping effort.
To rein it in was the idea.
And it was all begun by a conservative, allegedly small government president, George W. Bush. And then adopted and expanded by a presumably less conservative, much more liberal president in Barack Obama.
The Obama administration saying we're getting some oversight of this, but there's a lot of trust because so much of it is secret. Even U.S. senators saying, well, we can't talk about it. It's secret. If they can't, Sam in Lincoln, Massachusetts, you're on the air, Sam. Thanks for calling. Hello, Sam. Are you there, my friend? Let's go to Justin in Omaha, Nebraska. Justin, you're on. Oh, our phone calls don't seem to be coming through right now. We'll work on that. All right, let's turn to another front if we can for a second here. Susan Rice in the White House as National Security Advisor. After all the brouhaha over Benghazi, her time as UN Ambassador for the United States, sharp elbows, high profile, close to the president. Here he was welcoming her into her new role.
She is at once passionate and pragmatic. I think everybody understands Susan is a fierce champion for justice and human dignity. But she's also mindful that we have to exercise our power wisely and deliberately.
David Sanger, you're looking at the White House. Here's a president who, well, by all accounts, might have wanted her as Secretary of State. She's not there, but she's here. Is this a poke in the eye to Republicans who have so vigorously protested her? Or is this just the right person to be at his side at the NSA? NSC.
Well, it's a very different person to be at his side. I mean, Tom Donilon, the outgoing national security advisor, was a very cautious lawyer with a deep background in politics as well as in foreign policy. If he had sharp elbows, it was almost always used internally within the National Security Council. Didn't have much of a public presence. Susan Rice is quite different. She's been a very big advocate of American intervention abroad. She had said that if she ever had a chance to redo the Rwanda decision of the Clinton era when she was Assistant Secretary of State for mm-hmm. Africa, she would make sure that the United States got involved in humanitarian action. She was a big advocate of the U.S. action in going into Libya, or at least helping oust the Libyan leader, Muammar Gaddafi. And she's a much bigger public firebrand as well. I mean, she's recognizable in the public in a way that Mr. Donilon was not. She's going into a position for which Congress does not have any responsibility to confirm her.
Yeah, she's in.
So the president can put her in any job he wants.
Nancy Cordes, how do you think this is going to go down on Capitol Hill, and does it matter?
Well, the reaction from Republicans was pretty muted because, as David said, there's nothing they can really do about it. She doesn't need to be confirmed. And everyone was kind of watching to see how her three biggest critics would react, the Senators John McCain, Kelly Ayotte, and Lindsey Graham, who have been the most vocal Republicans about the way that she spoke about the Benghazi attacks on those five Sunday shows. Mm-hmm. And all three of them basically said, look, I disagree with his choice. I didn't like the way she spoke about Benghazi, but I'll make every effort to work with her on important issues. I'll work with her going forward. And so you haven't seen any kind of large-scale opposition being mounted on Capitol Hill.
Jack, you couldn't be more scathing than Republicans were on Susan Rice after Benghazi, but maybe her more aggressive posture lines up with what they'd like to see at the president's elbow.
Isn't that interesting, that her proclivity toward intervention, if that really is true? But, you know, she still has to deal with a boss who's very chary on the whole subject of intervention of any kind at any level in the Syrian imbroglio. And you know, the way things have gone, the moral argument has all been on the side of intervention. Of course, there's a powerful moral argument for humanitarian intervention just on the ground and refugee care and so on. But giving weapons to the rebels has been, you know, John McCain calls it, you know, a moral imperative. And the president has resisted that, and I think part of it is he understands that any theory of the morality of war involves the notion that it has to be workable, it has to be pragmatic. If anybody thinks that cratering a few runways in Syria is somehow going to mitigate this internecine civil war, that's going to somehow do it. I mean, it looks like a gratuitous act almost, given the scale of this atrocity. And then on the other side, the president has got to be cognizant of the morality here. Where's the morality of taking seniors who are losing their meals on wheels because of the sequester, of young people who are losing their head start, of all essentially taking Americans who are really losing out and sacrificing and spending that money in Syria. I mean, effectively saying, well, okay, this is more important and we're going to spend money in Syria, but we can't deal with you hungry seniors. I mean, moral argument there, too.
We get that. Americans watching that. At the same time, this concern about a regional meltdown in the Middle East and what that might mean. Here was sound just from this week of gunfire explosions between Syrian forces and opposition in the Duma, Qusair falling to the Assad government. And Lindsey Graham here, South Carolina, talking on Tuesday about the crisis there and its growing regional face.
I hope the American public doesn't want radical Islamists to have access to chemical weapons, and that's what's going to happen if this war continues to go on. I hope the American public understands that the King of Jordan is a very valuable ally to this country, second only to Israel, and I hope the world understands, not just the people of the United States, that the Syrian conflict is creating regional instability.
Nancy Curtis, we've seen President Obama leaning hard away from involvement here. Is the risk, which we're hearing more and more about, of regional instability changing minds on Capitol Hill? Polls show Americans still pretty chary about getting into another conflict. But what about in Congress, Nancy?
I think opinions on Capitol Hill just run the gamut on this issue, even within parties. You certainly have members of Congress like Senator McCain who are very strongly in favor of intervening in some way. And you have Republicans who say, you know, it's just too confusing. It's just too unclear who would run the country, how we would help, how we would get out for us to get involved. And so you don't see many members at all taking a really strong stand on this issue because I think it is so complicated and it's so confusing. You know, when you compare it to past conflicts like Libya, when we were considering getting involved, you had people who were much more vocal about whether we should or should not get involved. I think in this case, people are really torn. I think they see the merits of helping the rebels, but they are very concerned that we will get embroiled in something that doesn't have a clear endpoint.
On the other hand, David Sanger, Libya, in retrospect, looks small bore compared to Syria and its potential very wide implications.
It is small bore. First of all, you had the ability in Libya to affect the conflict from the air. There were troops in the desert who were easily targetable, who were approaching Benghazi. This was back, of course, in 2011. And instead, the president was able to commit for a short period of time and insisted that the Arab allies in the form of the Arab League and NATO take the lead. In the Syrian case, the Arab allies are nowhere to be seen. NATO says it does not want a piece of this. And there is no way to go do it from the air in a very easy way. You heard Lindsey Graham say no one wants the rebel groups, particularly the more extremist Islamist rebel groups, to get a hold of chemical weapons. Well, that's certainly the case. But if you bomb chemical weapons, you cause exactly the problem that you're trying to prevent. And if you go in to go grab them, well, they're not so movable, and suddenly you're stuck on the ground. So if there was an easy solution to the chemical weapons problem, I suspect it would have been done already. There isn't one.
And that likely to get more difficult if and when those Russian missiles, anti-aircraft missiles, really do show up. David Sanger, please
stand. Well, the Israelis have all but said that they would probably take those out.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, the trial of Army Private Bradley Manning began, accused of leaking classified information to WikiLeaks. Supporters marched outside the Fort Meade court-martial in Maryland.
Bradley Manning, set him free! Truth is not my enemy! Bradley Manning, set him free! Truth is not my enemy!
On Wednesday, a Philadelphia building collapsed, killing six. Anthony Sully's construction crew was working nearby, laying roof. They ran to help the victims.
We was laying roof. We heard a big bang, explosion or whatever. We looked over, everything was collapsed. We ran down, everybody ran down, and we went in there, and we started pulling people out.
And Gene Stapleton, All in the Family's Edith Bunker, is dead at 90. In a 1972 episode, Edith remembers her grandmother giving her a treasured locket.
She's put it around my neck, and she said, Edith, I want you to wear this always to remember me by. Those were her last words to me. Those and don't marry Archie.
Fly away, Glen River Plain.
Songs that made the hit parade.
Eyes like me, we had it made.
Oh, boy. There was a time when that was media revolution right there on the family. Archie and Edith and all the rest. So long, Gene Stapleton. We're looking at a week in the news. Big surveillance. Susan Rice, Bradley Manning, the High Court and DNA, the military and sexual assault. Nancy Cordes is with us. Congressional correspondent for CBS News. David Sanger is here. Chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. Jack Beatty's here. Nancy, that image of all those generals before the Senate committee was just something else. It looked like a dozen across. I didn't count them. Hard to see more epaulets and brass and glitter in one lineup of generals. And really getting the going over for this just rolling, unending issue with sexual assault in the military. Are we anywhere near to getting on top of it, Nancy?
Right. You had these military commanders on one side and then a phalanx of very angry women senators on the other side.
New day.
Who are proposing legislation to take sexual assault out of the chain of command. They say that these military commanders should not be the ones to decide when something is sexual assault, sexual harassment, and when it isn't, because clearly there's been a huge breakdown in the system. And as Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York said, look, not all commanders are objective. Not every commander wants women on the force. Not every commander knows or believes what a sexual assault is. They don't necessarily have the expertise. Take it out of the chain of command. But you had these commanders there, including the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the chief of staff of the Army, and on saying, no, we don't think that that's a good idea. We can handle it within the chain of command, essentially saying, well, we're going to try really, really hard this time to take this seriously.
David Singer, we heard at the top of the hour in that tape, Kirsten Gillibrand saying there may be high-ranking officials who don't even want women in the military. That was news to me at this point. I mean, is that still an issue here? Is that somehow related to this whole mess of assault?
You know, if it was a surprise to me, too. And that's certainly not what I hear either from the senior American military commanders or from many of the troops that, you know, I get a moment to talk to usually when they come back from Iraq or Afghanistan wherever else they've been deployed. I think at this point that argument is long over, as is the argument about women in combat, something that President Obama finally moved on. So I think that the big question now is how do you get the rest of the troops accustomed to that? And the sexual harassment issue and where those numbers have gone up is the single biggest symbol and impediment.
Let's hear it. I mean, all those women, Nancy, as you say, in the Senate now, really bringing the heat. And not just the women, we'll hear that as well. But this was Kay Hagan, Democrat Senator, North Carolina, argued against the current chain of command approach, saying it can damage careers beyond the victims.
I am concerned that at the lower levels, especially at the lower levels, there may be an environment in which commanders believe that they've got to sweep sexual assault reports under the rug in order to avoid a perception that they're not properly leading their units.
That the motivations just aren't lined up right if they're thinking about career or the right thing when you've got that chain of command responsibility. But we saw right in the middle of that huge military lineup, there was Army Chief of Staff Ray Odierno. Boy, he's a presence, kind of a hulking there, standing by chain of command.
I want the commander fully involved in the decisions that have an impact on the morale and cohesion of the unit, to include punishment.
And then, Jack, there was John McCain speaking up in the middle of all this saying, you know, I'm not even sure I could recommend to a friend that their daughter go into the military anymore.
Just last night, a woman came to me and said her daughter wanted to join in the military, and could I give my unqualified support for her doing so?
Thanks.
I could not.
That ought to be a heads up to the U.S. military at a time when, you know, that we've just been through a decade where recruiting was a big issue.
You know, this documentary, The Invisible War, that won an Academy Award last year, I mean, it's about this horror. In effect, there's an invisible war going on against women in the military. I mean, 26,000 people in the survey, anonymous survey, say they have been sexually molested or assaulted in one way or another. Yet out of the 26,000, only 3,200 reported cases in 2011, only 2,400 prosecutions. Out of that, only 191 convictions. Out of that, only 150 people sentenced to jail. I mean, that is the invisible war. That is the status quo. And the generals weren't hearing it. They kept defending the status quo. Finally, one of the senators said, but wait, this is what you're defending. You can't do it. And, you know, I just wish that Sarah Plummer, who's an ex-Marine who was raped by a fellow Marine who was never prosecuted, I just wished she had been there, because in one sentence she blew this whole idea of the chain of command, gave it the reductio ad absurdum. She said, having someone within your direct chain of command handling the case is like your brother raping you and having your dad decide the case.
Oh, talk about a tough situation. Roger in Charleston, South Carolina, you're on the air. Hello, Roger. Are you there? Well, let's go to...
Tom?
Yes, Roger. You're on.
Hi. Actually, I just wanted to point out, I was in the Army for going on 5 years, and one of the things is that it's not just females that are being sexually assaulted. Male and male sexual assault is actually on the rise as well. And one of the things that I wanted to point out was with the commanders making the decision, a lot of times the soldiers are kept within the same unit, and still have to see each other on a day-to-day basis and still have to work with each other on a day-to-day basis. So I just kind of wanted to point that out, and that's why one of the main things I think it should be taken out of their control, because it's a crime and should be handled by the courts, by the UCMJ, not by a commander.
Yeah, Robert, I appreciate your call there. I mean, Nancy, you know, there's a first-hand report, and we saw that also in the reporting numbers. It's not just male on female. It just looks like a mess that somehow has gotten away from the military command structure, Nancy.
Right. And another point that a lot of the female senators in particular made was that sometimes when one of these cases happens, you've got a commander making a decision about something that one of his superiors allegedly committed. You know, he's deciding whether someone who has control over him committed sexual assault. And that is very tricky and political as well. And that's why they were saying that, you know, it's just another reason why you should take it out of the chain of command.
Boy, there's brother and father and grandfather. It gets worse and worse. It's going to be interesting to watch that phalanx of female senators, as you say, Nancy, grapple with this in the weeks ahead. I want to turn to the economy for a minute. David Sanger, numbers out today is pretty much right on what was expected, 175,000 jobs, unemployment titching just a little bit up, not down this time. What about the economy and the lift that it's got or doesn't have right now? David, what do you see?
Well, the oddity here is you have an economy that is sort of sputtering along and a stock market that, except for this week, was really taking off. And I think part of the difference is that what you see in these job numbers is that companies have figured out, because of the efficiencies they brought about during the recession starting in 08 and 09, that they can make it through without committing to big numbers of new hires. There are some exceptions to that, including in the manufacturing space. But the recovery does not, to their mind, have to necessarily be linked to major scale hiring. And so what we're seeing is nice numbers. This was 175,000, as you said, and doing well in the private sector, which is making up for the fact that the government has really had a lag behind because of sequester. But you're not seeing the kind of boom that you saw as the recovery occurred in the Clinton years.
Nancy, do we still have a debt ceiling deficit, you know, fiscal debate coming up later this year? And how does the economy's health weigh on that?
I think that that is always looming. The president and the speaker of the House sort of traded jabs this week, saying, you know, well, I'm glad to see that the other side doesn't look like they want to take us over another cliff, but we'll see. There are certainly always a number of conservatives who are itching for that fight and see it as a means to sort of extract big spending cuts, which is what they're looking for. But in general, we don't see any more sort of these big outcries every month when these jobs numbers come out. It used to be even just 6 months ago to a year ago, mm-hmm. every time the jobs numbers came out and they were sort of disappointing, you would have a lot of Republicans and Republican leadership saying, look, this is just more proof that the Obama administration is not doing enough to bring jobs back. But because you don't really have either side doing much at this point to work to bring jobs back, I think that everybody's being a little bit more circumspect about that.
We've got callers still on the military sex problems. Jonah in Boston, you're on the air, Jonah.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to comment on sexual assault in the military. I'm a former Marine. When I was in boot camp, I remember there was a culture, even before I graduated boot camp, there's this assumption, it was drilled into you, that women Marines, female Marines, are going to accuse male Marines of sexual assault, maybe set their careers back, maybe launch their sport. But even before you got in, there was a perception that women were going to do this before you even entered the fleet.
You mean do it falsely? Is that what the idea, Jonah?
Correct. Just trying to almost this culture, right? So this culture was in place that you would do it falsely.
So there's a sort of a convenient construction that if the charges come, they're likely to be false to mess with your career. Yeah, there's a lot to watch there, and we will, Jonah. I appreciate your call. We turn to Chris Christie for a moment. What's going on in the U.S. Senate there more broadly? But first, of course, Senator Frank Lautenberg died on Monday, longest serving senator, many, many years there. And so the governor of New Jersey had to decide when to have a special election or, you know, when to have the election to get a replacement in there. I guess we all know what he did. Jon Stewart went after him on The Daily Show for putting up the big money to call. I have a special election in October. Stewart dipped back into Christie's own comments in the past. Here's Stewart on The Daily Show.
In 2009, Governor Christie commented specifically on what he would do when he was asked, and this is true, if Frank Lautenberg died.
I don't think any responsible governor at this point would call for a special election that would cost $10 million.
Of course they wouldn't.
Yeah, well, of course he did. This was the governor of New Jersey, Chris Christie, on Tuesday. Well, here he is.
I don't know what the cost is, and I quite frankly don't care. I don't think you can put a price tag on what it's worth to have an elected person in the United States Senate. And I will do whatever I need to do to make sure those costs are covered, because all the people of the state of New Jersey will benefit from it. And we're not going to be penny wise and pound foolish around here.
I don't care what it costs, Jack. He's going to have a special election in October. And explain to us why, Jack, what's going on here?
Well, he doesn't want to be on the same ballot in November, just three weeks later, when he's up for re-election
yep.
with Newark Mayor Cory Booker.
Popular Democrat.
Who would pull out a lot of Democratic votes, and they would result in a lower vote for the governor. The governor isn't going to lose his race, no matter what happens, but it would be a lower vote, possibly. And worse, from his point of view, it might cost Republican seats in the Assembly, and he wants to get a good record over the next couple of years so he can run for president, and he needs a good vote for his assembly, for Republican assembly members and state senators. So that's
whatever it costs.
And naked self-interest sometimes is just wonderful to view. You know, he says, I'm doing this, and I think he had some high-minded rationale, but no one. You could
the
just
health
see
of democracy is at stake here.
Right. Hey, yeah.
Nancy, speaking of that next presidential election, hate to go there, but Marco Rubio recently seemed maybe to move away a little bit from his support of immigration reform, to be lined up right with Tea Party Republicans. What's going on there, Nancy?
Yes, and that was really mystifying. He went to meet with conservative Republicans in the House this week who have some questions and concerns about his immigration plan that he crafted with three other Republicans and four Democrats. And he came out of that meeting and said, well, you know, there's big problems with this plan when it comes to securing the border. We definitely need to work on that and fix that. Otherwise, you know, it might not pass. And that left his Republican colleagues on the Gang of Eight completely mystified. They said, hey, you were one of the authors of this plan. You know, why are you now trash-talking it, this could cause a lot of concern among Republicans who might otherwise vote for it that perhaps, you know, there's something wrong with it now if Senator Marco Rubio himself is saying that there's a problem. So I spoke to Senator Lindsey Graham, who's also on that Gang of Eight, and he himself was very surprised that Senator Rubio had taken this tack. He said maybe Rubio felt pressure from the right, but on the other hand, if this immigration plan goes down, then he's not going to have much to show for his legislative record if he does decide to run for president.
David Sanger, it's not easy for Republicans to line up on that runway these days with these cross currents of sort of mainstream and Tea Party Republican perspective buffeting them.
It sure isn't. I mean, they've got sort of three kinds of problems. One is the division within the party itself about which way it wants to go. And you see those in the immigration debate. You see it in gay rights debates, though that many Republicans have begun to acknowledge is largely that debate's pretty much over as a political issue for their platform, certainly not over within the real world. And then you see a big argument on just the kind of issues that we were discussing today, like big government. They're not quite sure whether they want to come out and condemn the National Security Agency for invading people's lives under President Obama's time, and then have to deal with the question of how this all started in the Bush era with many of them voting for it. So it's a difficult time to figure out if you're a Republican where you're putting yourself within the spectrum.
Hey, David, just a couple of seconds. Michelle Obama and her huffiness with that heckler. Is she getting tired of this gig?
Well, she certainly made it sound like she was not, during her president's second term, going to sort of sit there and smile when people challenge her.
We saw that. David Sanger with the New York Times, Nancy Cordes with CBS News, Jack Beatty, thank you so much to you all. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.